Okay. Everybody wants peace of mind. When we meditate and we find out the tricks to be able to get peace of mind. You can't expect to get peace of mind just by arranging the situation around you to be just so, to be perfect, to be exactly as you like. Because the world is never exactly as you like. There's always something wrong. So we have to find a way of getting peace of mind, no matter what we're experiencing. And you find with meditation, it doesn't matter even if you're too hot, too cold, too tired, you're sick or you're healthy, those sorts of things don't matter. If you know the trick of peace of mind, you can have this peace at any time, in any place. Even when you're active, you can still keep that peace of mind. And in particular, when one understands how to keep that peace of mind in daily life, one can apply the same techniques to have peace of mind when you're meditating. And that peace of mind when you're meditating builds and builds and builds. And this is the point of meditation, to build up that peace of mind so you have this incredible peace. That peace is another word for stillness, when the mind doesn't move anywhere. It's just so wonderful, so nice. And because of that happiness, you just don't want to move. And this enormous stillness there, the peace. So we all know that's the goal of this meditation. And it's once learnt in meditation, you can apply it to other experiences in your daily life. But today I want to talk about the obstacles to that peace. And why it is that sometimes people come to a meditation retreat and everything is just so perfect. You don't have to think about what you eat. It's all there for you. You don't have to go struggling for it. It's served there. You don't have to cook it. I think you have to wash up a little bit, but not that much. The amount of work you have to do is just so minimal. This should be paradise here. There's nothing to do for 9 days. Nothing to worry about. No work, no family to bother you. Husbands, you have no wives to nag, 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 nag. Wives, you've got no husbands to have to cook and slave over. You're just so free. So why is it that even though the situation here should be perfect, why is it that sometimes we don't have peace of mind? So today I'm going to talk about the barriers to peace of mind. First barrier to peace of mind, it's basically the 5 hindrances, but I'm going to put them in a different order than usual. The first barrier to peace of mind which you will experience on a meditation retreat is thinking. Because people think too much. They're always thinking. And it's a thinking which is perhaps human beings' biggest barrier to peace of mind. And so I usually tell a story about thinking. And it shows you just how, when you learn just to let go and just to be peaceful and still and just attend to the task at hand, the life becomes so easy. And it's a story which some of you have heard before. I don't think I'd put it in my book, though I might have done. It's a story when, in my monastery in northeast of Thailand, Ajahn Chah was building his main hall in the monastery. And even though that monastery was built on the flat plains of the northeast, at least he wanted to build the main hall on a small hill. So it was literally a monk-made hill. Can you not hear? Can you not hear in the back? Really? Is that better? Okay. Listen, if you can't hear, don't just sit there. Just go up and say, Ajahn Brahm, we can't hear. When I talked about peace, it's not the type of peace I meant where you can't hear anything. I meant like the contentment and that sort of stuff. So I'll try and put this thing closer to my mouth. So, I was talking about these barriers to peace of mind, how to create peace. And the first big barrier is thinking too much. And I started to tell the story of when my master Ajahn Chah started building his main hall in his monastery. It was built on a small man-made hill built of earth. And there was lots of earth left over. And so Ajahn Chah got us monks together. I was there. And he said, monks, that earth which is left over, it's just ugly in that place. It's spoiling the view. I want you to move it round to the back. And he pointed out the place. And that was a lot of earth. and all we had was shovels and wheelbarrows. And so we had to work. We have our one meal of the day, which was actually quite early, maybe about 8:45, but it was all finished by 9:30, because that's when we started working, 9:30 in the morning. And we went without a break to about 9:00 at night. When it got dark, they had these kerosene lanterns, which we would take out so we could see where we were pushing the earth. We were working so hard in the hot, humid, sweaty, mosquito-ridden jungle monasteries of northeast Thailand, getting bitten by these terrible mosquitoes, pushing these heavy wheelbarrows, sweating and laboring. It was so hard. But I had faith. This was for my teacher, for my monastery. And so I didn't mind working really hard. The next day and the day after, it took us 3 hard days to move all that earth, pushing it, shoveling it. It was dirty, sweaty, very unpleasant work. But after 3 days, we finished. And I thought, great, I made a lot of merit and good karma. Now I can have a good shower. Tomorrow I can have a nice meditate, have a rest. But that night, my master Ajahn Chah decided to go to visit another monastery. So, in the morning, the deputy abbot, and some of you have met him now, because he came to Ipoh a short while ago, Ajahn Liam. It was him who did this. I remember him. Because he was number 2 at that time, and he brought all the monks together, and he said, I think the earth is in the wrong place. Move it. I'll move it. It's in the wrong place. Move it. And we have to spend another 3 days moving it home. But I still had faith. I was a peaceful mind. My meditation was going well. So I did. But I sort of minded. But I thought, okay, another 3 days. We get it right this time. So for another 3 days of dirty, sweaty work in the hot, mosquito-ridden jungle monastery of northeast Thailand. Oh, it was hard work. But after 3 days, it was finished. And I thought, great, now everyone's happy. Now I can just go and have a nice rest. Tomorrow I can meditate. You know what happened? That night, Ajahn Chah came back. And first thing in the morning, he got all the monks together and he said, monks, I thought I told you to put the earth over there. It's over here. Move it. And so we had to move that earth again. And by this time, whatever faith I had, I'd lost. I didn't know these Thai monks, they're supposed to be great arahats and masters. Can't they even decide where a piece of earth should be? They can't do this to me. I didn't become a monk just to be a labourer. I want to meditate. I'm trying to become enlightened, not push these blooming bits of earth. I was really angry. I was really upset. And the other monks could see that. When you're really angry, you can't hide it. And one of them came up to me. And what they said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it, that's the hard part. It was true. At that moment, I got what we call an insight, who understood what the problem was. And I had enough, confidence in this monk who told me this. I tried it. I stopped thinking about it. And as soon as I stopped thinking about it, that wheelbarrow became quite light. It was easy to push. And the other 3 days, they went past very quickly. It was no problem. And I realized it wasn't the wheelbarrow which was the problem. It was the thinking which is the problem. It is the thinking which makes the wheelbarrow heavy, not the earth. And so I learned a very important piece of Dhamma from that experience, which is why to this day I think those two, Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Liam, planned it all from the very start to teach us monks about how just to do it without thinking about it. Now this is the same with your meditation. Why can't you just do the meditation instead of thinking about it so much? If they just sit there, just watch the breath, eat it, just don't think about it. Just doesn't matter just how many days and hours you have to meditate. Just you've only got this moment, just go and do it. Don't think about it. Don't think, oh my goodness, I've got all afternoon, I've got to meditate. Another 5 hours, oh, what am I going to do? I can't go to sleep because I can't go, you know, I lay down but I can't go to sleep. I walk, I get tired. I sit, I get bored. Oh, what am I going to do? Stop thinking about it and just do it. Just sit there and shut up. That's basic meditation. Sit down, shut up, be mindful. That's my meditation teaching in brief. Sit down, shut up, and be mindful. But so many people find it hard to stop thinking. Why? One of the main reasons is because you're afraid to stop thinking. You've been thinking so long since you were very small. You are attached to your thinking. This is what attachment means. We don't like giving it up. Even though we should know it's a wonderful thing to give up from time to time. Just to be peaceful, not to think about anything, just to enjoy the moment. But because we've been trained and conditioned from the time we were very, very small, even when you first went to your primary school, in your grade one, and your teacher said, what do you think about this? And you said nothing and got into trouble. What a shame. Because you could have been a great meditator, but your teacher spoiled it for you and made you think. And now look where you are. Think, think, think. But there is still hope for you. Because I can recondition you to stop thinking. And this is one of the great teachings for a person to be able to stop thinking. Now, many of you have heard me do this exercise before. But if you've heard me do it, just please, if you've experienced it before, please join in. Because I want you all to not just listen to me, but I want you to listen to your mind. Listen to what's going on inside your mind when I am speaking, with some pauses between my words. What's going on in your mind? You were quiet. You weren't thinking. You were silent. Because you were waiting. You never knew when I was going to say something then. Because I made some pauses between my speech, you had to be silent. Now, that's what silence feels like. The space between words, like the space between your thoughts, the inner silence. The first thing I want you to do by having this exercise is to show you what silence feels like. To let you experience it. So you know what we're talking about. And so then you can become familiar with that inner silence, that pause between the thinking mind. Once you become familiar with it, you become comfortable with it. In that comfort, you can go back to that silence again and again and again. And you can rest there. You find you're not afraid of the silence anymore. I say afraid of the silence because my monastery in Perth is very quiet. Simply because the forest, the bush in Australia, they don't have so many insects which make all these noises. So it's actually incredibly silent. But what I found when we had visitors coming into this very quiet monastery, sometimes I noticed they'd speak with a loud voice, louder than usual. And it always was strange. Why, in quiet places, did people tend to shout? Until it became clear to me that The silence was challenging them. They weren't comfortable in quietness, so they had to disturb it even more. They were overreacting to the silence. This is what happens. This is what I mean by being afraid of quietness and silence. You don't know what to do. You can't relax. You can't be at peace with it. So by becoming familiar with the silence that I've just shown you, it's such a beautiful experience. It's comfortable. Once you get to know it, you can stay with it for longer and longer periods. It's a place of rest where you feel welcome. So you stay there. So for those of you who are thinking a lot during the meditation, try that technique. See the spaces between your thoughts. There's always spaces between your thoughts. When one thought has ended and the next thought is yet to begin, but we don't tend to notice them. When you notice them, you find they're there. You can go to that silence between your thoughts. You find that space grows and grows. The silence becomes bigger than the space occupied by the thoughts. In the same way, you can come into a hall like this. So what do you notice when you come into this hall? You can notice the Buddha statue, you can notice me, all the yogis here, the walls, the fans. But how many of you, when you come in here, notice the space which is between each of the yogis? The emptiness which surrounds and embraces us all. In this hall, there's much more space and emptiness than there are things. But we tend only to notice the things. In the same way, in your mind, there's much more emptiness than there are thoughts. But for the time being, you've only begun to notice your thoughts, the objects in the mind, not the space, the silence which surrounds us and between the thoughts. All it is a change of perception. In this room, not noticing the things, but the space which surrounds it. In your mind, not noticing the thoughts, but the space and the emptiness which is between and surrounds all of your thoughts. Then you know how to turn to the silence. Once you can establish that silence in the mind, that peace, that ability just to listen, then all the other parts of meditation become so easy. The silence is the most important barrier to, or rather the thought is the most important barrier to overcome, to enter the silence of the mind. Within the silence of the mind is lots of contentment. You can't say anything, you can't do anything. You're just silent, you're just watching. You're not talking back to life. You're observing it. And you're observing it without measuring. One of the other obstacles and barriers to peace of mind is measuring. Why do we always measure and compare? Try to do a meditation where you don't measure or compare at all. Is this a good meditation or a bad meditation? How on earth can you say? What are you trying to compare it with? What's your standard of measurement for a good meditation or a bad meditation? It's just a meditation, that's all. When you don't compare your meditation, then you have no destination, no goal anymore. It becomes good enough. All this comparing, first of all, this measuring, the first measurement we make is the measurement of time. What does time actually mean? When we meditate, time can be a huge barrier to success in our meditation. Because what happens with time, many of you start to think, how many hours can I sit meditation for? As if this is some exercise to get in the Guinness Book of Records, to see which yogi can sit for the longest period. Now you don't get in any record, you don't get a medal, for sitting down long periods. As I said yesterday, if that was the case, the chickens would beat you many think they can sit on these eggs for days at a time without moving. So it's nothing to do with how many hours. Don't measure the time. If you start measuring the time, that's when we start to get tense. That's when we start to get frustrated, irritated, because we think, how long do I have to bear with this? How many more minutes until I can go to bed? How long do I have to endure this? All of this is just because we allow time to dominate our consciousness. We start measuring things. When you stop measuring time, you can't control time anymore. This is an insight which I got when somebody reminded me of a saying of Lord Kelvin. He was a philosopher and an engineer in the UK some 350 years ago, I think. If there's any engineers or scientists here, you know that he gave his name to a temperature scale of absolute zero, the Kelvin scale of temperature, -273 degrees centigrade is 0 degrees Kelvin. Absolute zero. But he was also a philosopher and a founder of modern technology. Because he famously said, if we want to control nature, first of all, we have to learn how to accurately measure it, first of all. And as any scientist or engineer knows, accurate measurement has to come first. When we can measure things, then we've got some way of controlling it. When somebody asked me that, I turned it around and said, just how profound that is, but let's turn it around. If you stop measuring, you can't control. There's no way, no means to control when you stop measuring. When you stop measuring time, you're letting go of time. You can't control the passage of time. You can't control the flow of your consciousness through time. When you let go of measuring, time disappears. Because what is measuring anyway? How long am I going to give a talk for? I don't measure it anymore. All measuring is some distance from the present to the future, the past to the present, or the past to the future. All those things we don't need to consider when we're meditating. If we stop measuring the time, which is in this moment, letting go of all concepts of hours, minutes, seconds, then you find there's a freedom. It's a freedom of not being a control freak in time. How many of you get so tense and worried about whether you're going to make it in time? You're worried whether you're going to make the aircraft in time for your plane back to Perth. I have to worry about that because some of my disciples in Singapore deliberately take me to the restaurant first of all, give me a breakfast, start talking to me. And when I get to the gate, they say, look, I better rush, the plane's leaving. They start taking photographs. It's sort of planned to make sure I miss the plane so I can give another talk. That's what I think anyway. They come close a few times, I did the last one back on the plane, but I've always managed to make it so far. But why do we get worried about time? And why does that give us so much tension and lack of peace? And we start worrying about what is going to happen next. Do you want to know what is going to happen next? Shall I tell your future for you? You know there are some monks who can tell futures. And Ajahn Chah is a famous monk. I put this story in my book. Only once has he told somebody's future. It was a disciple of his who had been looking after this master for so long. He said, Ajahn Chah, read the lines on the palm of my hand. Tell me what my future is going to be. I know you can do it. And Ajahn Chah said, look, I don't do that. I'm a good monk. But this disciple would not give up. He said, look, I've given you so much food over all of these years. Sometimes I've taken my time off work to drive you to the station or drive you to appointments. I've lost so much money looking after you. It's the very least you can do to read the lines on the palm of my hand. I know you can do it. And so Ajahn Chah, for the only time in his life, gave him. He said, okay, I will tell your future. And so this man was so excited. He gave Ajahn Chah his palm. And this master, Ajahn Chah, with his finger, started tracing the lines on this man's hand. He traced them very slowly, because he was concentrating. And every now and again he would pause and say, "Oh, that's interesting. Look at that. Now that is significant." And this man was getting more and more excited. He couldn't wait for Ajahn Chah to finish, so he could find out what his future was going to be. Because Ajahn Chah was never wrong. And he wasn't wrong. But when he gave his hand back, and the man said, "Yes, well, what's it going to be? What's my future going to be?" Ajahn Chah replied, "Sir, your future, yes, yes, yes. And I never make a mistake. I know, get on with it. Your future, sir, is uncertain." And Ajahn Chah wasn't wrong. He was winding him up all the time to teach him some Dhamma. The future is uncertain. No one can tell what is going to happen next. No one. So because of that, why do we worry about what's going to happen next? You don't know whether the next moment you're going to be fully enlightened or drop dead. Who knows what might happen next? So, we don't worry about the future. We don't measure it. Instead, we stay in the present moment. Not measuring or comparing this moment with any other moment. This moment is completely unique, original, by itself. It will never be repeated again in the whole history of samsara. So why do we throw away this moment, thinking that the next moment will be better or somehow different? I've told you before that nirvana, enlightenment, lies right in this very moment you're looking at now. You just can't see it. You're not going deep enough into this moment. So, when we give up time, we don't measure time. Much of the way we can think is taken away. Most of our thinking is about the future or the past. When we think about the past, we get into guilt or depression or resentment, anger, what someone did to us. bad things we did. Let go of the past. How's your meditation been so far? Who cares? It's all gone, it's past. What's happened so far doesn't matter at all. What's happening now is the only thing which is concerns you. So I've done this many times. Sometimes I've been very sleepy and I thought, forget it. Let go of the past. And when you let go of the past, you're free to become enlightened in the next moment, in this moment. If you keep carrying around the past, you can never get peaceful. Are you a good meditator or a bad meditator? What does that mean? It means, what have you done in the past? Let it go. There's no such thing as a good meditator or a bad meditator. More measuring. When it's a measuring, you try and control. When it's control, is always doing, and you're disturbing the process. Stop measuring. This moment is good enough. Completely unique, cannot compare it with any other moment it's ever been. Thereby, you allow it to be. That way, we find that we don't even think, we don't compare, and most importantly, we don't expect. So much thinking is about expecting. What should I do next? Too often people come in the interviews and they say they got to this and that stage of meditation. Now, what should I do next, they say. And I tell them, stupid question. It's not what I'm going to do next. That doesn't even come into it. In meditation, it's what am I doing now?
That's the only question you need to ask. Not what should I do next, but what am I doing now? When you start to think of the next moment, you're not paying attention to this one. That's why you're missing Nibbana when it's coming to call. Just leave it alone. Now that is an important teaching in this meditation. Because too often the people go so well, they start to get peaceful, they've let go of time, they've let go of this thinking mind, they're just silent, they can watch the breath, and then they start thinking, what next? Stop thinking like that, it's what's happening now. That's all you need to think about. To tell you exactly what I mean, this is a simile of meditation, which gives you a very good overview of the whole path of meditation and why all this thinking and moving business, why going off into the future or the past, why all this controlling misses the point. This simile is a simile of the thousand-petaled lotus. It's a simile which I've borrowed from Tibetan Buddhism, because many of you would have known the very famous Vajrayana mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. But you know what that means? It means like we worship the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The jewel in the heart of the lotus. And what does that mean? I will now tell you what that means. A lotus, as everyone should know, is a flower which closes up all its petals at night. And in the first rays of the sun in the early morning, when they hit the outermost petal of the lotus begins to open up. It opens up layer by layer of petals. First of all, the outermost petal opens up to reveal the next layer of petals. Because the outermost layer has opened up, the sun can now warm the layer underneath. Then that opens up to reveal the next layer of petals, so that can heat up and also open to reveal the next layer. Layer after layer they open up. And as you should know from a lotus flower or any flower, it is the outermost petals are the coarse, dirty, unrefined ones. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more fragrant, the more delicate, the more profound those petals become. Until you get to the very innermost petals of the lotus. And then the sun, if it warms those petals, they too can open up to reveal the jewel in the heart of the lotus. In this simile, the lotus stands for you. And the sun stands for mindfulness. When you start mindfulness on this body and mind, on life if you like, it starts to open up to reveal what's in the middle. First of all, you sit down, close your eyes, and there you are in the middle of life. If mindfulness continues, then time opens up to reveal the present moment, what's in the middle of this thing we call time. If mindfulness continues on present moment awareness, soon this thinking mind will open up until you get what's in the middle of thought, which is silence. The silence will open up. What's in the middle of the silence will be your meditation object, the breath. The breath will eventually open up to get the full awareness of the breath. In the middle of that full awareness of the breath, you find the beautiful breath. In the middle of the beautiful breath, right in its center, when the beautiful breath opens out, it will reveal this nimitta, this wonderful light in the mind. In the middle of that nimitta lies the first jhana. It opens out like the petals of a lotus, so fragrant and so beautiful, so profound, beyond your imagination. In the middle of the first jhana, you'll find the second jhana, these incredible innermost petals. In the middle of the second, the third, the middle of the third, the fourth. In the middle of the fourth jhana, the first immaterial state, and the next immaterial state, the next immaterial state. In the middle of the third immaterial state, there's a fourth immaterial state. In the middle of that, the last breath of all,
You find the jewel in the heart of the lotus. What's in the center of everything? If you want to find out what that is, you have to come in a couple of days' time when I talk about enlightenment. But now, I'm talking about the path to open up that lotus. The problem of meditators is if the sun starts shining on the lotus, a few petals open up, and then they go on to the next lotus. Which means that this lotus all closes up, and they lose all of their momentum. We don't need to go on to anything other than what we're experiencing now. We don't go on to the next thing. We go into this thing. Expecting is looking at the next lotus, the one adjacent to the one which is being warmed now, which means that the sun is not shining on this first lotus anymore, or the petals close out. When you understand that simile, you understand what I meant by letting go, allowing mindfulness just to shine on this moment, just to be with it, to have, be more fully aware of this very moment now, no matter what it is. Not to expect anything, not to think, now I've done this, I've got to do something else. You're doing the right thing already. Just be still, relax, shut up, be mindful. Don't go anywhere, don't move. Because it's the moving which is a barrier to the peace of mind. We always are managers, we interfere with the process. We can't leave anything alone. We're backseat drivers. I gave this simile some years ago, because I do a lot of travelling in the aircraft. It's like some people get on the aircraft, they go from KL to Perth, and some people, they just rush to the front of the aircraft, thinking they're going to get to Perth quicker. And of course, you're wasting your time. These are all you meditators who put forth effort and strive. You rush, 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 thinking you're going to get to enlightenment quicker. Just like people rushing to the front of the aircraft, thinking they're going to get to the destination quicker. That's not the way to get to the destination. Your job is not to put forth effort. That effort, that struggle, that craving, it all comes from controlling. You're measuring. You're thinking that this moment is somehow not good enough for enlightenment. The enlightenment is somewhere else other than right here. You think this jhanas is something you get by working hard. You can try that and try that for years and years and years, until one day the penny drops, you're going in the wrong direction. You don't go on to the next stage of meditation. You go in to the next stage of meditation. If you can imagine that lotus, this mind state which you can know right now, in the center of that is all the jhanas. You just got to unwrap it, that's all. Unwrap this present moment. So we let go of thinking. We also let go of desire and ill will. This controlling. To have desire, again, it's always comparing, measuring again. This is not as good as that. When you compare, then there'll be controlling. It's a measuring. Not comparing. This is good enough. There can be no desire when you don't compare. Nor can there be any ill will when you don't compare. So stop comparing things. In your meditation, no matter what you're experiencing, don't give it a name. Don't say this is peaceful, this is restless, this is sloth, this is thinking. Don't give it a name, because all name is a measuring. When you start to measure, you have some weird business to do. As soon as you give it a name, this is not peaceful, then you've got something to do with that. If you say, this is peaceful, then again that creates more business, because you have to make it more peaceful. There's always something more to do.
when you give things name, you start measuring.
So see if you can go into the measureless samadhi, where you don't compare at all. So jhanas, first jhana, second jhana, nimittas, you don't even give them names.
You just become more peaceful, more aware of this moment. You've got nothing to do, nowhere to go. So you just stay here. Can you understand how peace of mind grows from that?
It grows like a flower. It just grows like a swell of energy, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like a big fire starting from a small spark and growing into this huge blaze of peace and stillness. Now that you can understand what the barriers are to peace of mind. Measuring, comparing, thinking. Those are the barriers. They take a lot of guts and courage not to measure. Because you've been taught to do that ever since you were small. It goes against the grain. You always compare. You take, not just take notes, you assess your progress throughout your meditation. Is this a good one or a bad one? Am I going well? Am I not going well? It creates more thoughts and more business. More things to disturb you. Many of you might have figured out I've just done a very brief commentary on the third Zen patriarch's famous poem, where it starts off, "The path is easy for those who make no measurements." It's a very famous poem which I read as a kid, straight from Mahayana. There's a Theravada man teaching it today, because it works. It gets you into deep meditation very quickly. The path of meditation is easy if you make no measurements. No good, no bad. No peace, no restlessness. Nothing. When you can't give it a name, when you don't measure it, it's beyond your control. You can't do anything. When you can't do anything, you don't do anything. When you don't do anything, everything slows down and stops. And you become peaceful. Another way of letting go. So these are some of the barriers which we have. The desire and aversion all comes from this measuring and comparing. When you come out of meditation, you have to do these things. When you come out of meditation, you have to think, you have to worry about time, you have to do this and do that. But in meditation, this is a different world. So don't get confused about, is Ajahn Brahm telling us we should not measure when we leave this place? Is Ajahn Brahm saying we shouldn't compare? Is Ajahn Brahm saying we should stop thinking and just be zombies when we walk out of this place? This is just what you do when you're meditating. You can be a zombie here, but not when you go home. So what I mean by that is you can make the mind just so still and become so easy. The biggest barrier is always these first two hindrances, desire and aversion. That's what the Buddha said, the main two hindrances, wanting something or not wanting something, all come from comparing and measuring. Desire and ill will is controlling, is doing something. Just imagine, no desire, no ill will, this is good enough. No matter what it is. And then you imagine what it's like to have no hindrances, to be fully content. If you can have that contentment, you don't want anything. And what you have, you're happy with it. In this moment, sure, out there in the world you won't survive, but in this meditation retreat, this is what you're supposed to be doing. To give yourself the peace of mind. No desire. When you're meditating, you're trying to get something, are you desiring? When you're meditating, have you got aversion? You're not happy where you are, you want to be somewhere else? You're not happy with your sloth and torpor? You want to be into jhana, you've heard of this great blissful state? Yeah, that's what I want. desire, 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 ill will, ill will, ill will. Those are the essential barriers. When you start to have desire or ill will, that's where the thinking starts from. It's what I call discontent. So see if you can build up this contentment in the moment. Great way of doing that is by not measuring. This is good enough. I can't compare it with anything else. You're content. For those of you who've got a wife, if you get one of these glossy girly magazines and compare her to the girl on the front cover, then you're not content with her anymore. Only from comparisons do you get discontent. If you look at your husband, look at someone who's earning twice as much, who's just really beautiful, like Richard Gere. I mention him because we're inviting him to our conference in Perth next year. So we invited Richard Gere to come to the fourth global conference on Buddhism, which I'm organizing. So you girls, if you play your cards right, you can bring the chauffeur and pick him up from the airport. You going to come? But sometimes when we compare our husband to Richard Gere and say, what did I marry him for? And that's when you get ill will and desire. So it's always from comparison that we get these business to be done and move with the mind. When you're content with your partner, you're at peace. So we look at contentment. And the great thing with contentment is you can be content with anything. There's one of my famous stories, and I don't mind repeating this many times because this is powerful. There's a story where one of my monks went to go and teach in jail, in a top security jail in Perth, a new one. After teaching there for many weeks, the prisoners asked him to stay back. They wanted to give him some tea and have a chat. And so when they were giving him some tea after the meditation class, they started to ask him, what is it like in your monastery? And he started to explain life in a forest monastery in Australia. He said, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. The prisoner said, what? 4 o'clock in the morning? Even in prison you don't have to get up at that time. But then what do you do? Can you have some breakfast? No, you have to wait till at least 6:30 or 7 o'clock before you can even have a cup of tea. What? You can't even have a cup of coffee? No. What do? Listen to the news, watch the movies in the early morning? No, there's no television or radio in my monastery. What? Said the prisoners, even in jail you're allowed a TV. But what do you have for breakfast? Can you have bacon and eggs? No, they said, maybe some cereal, if you're lucky. And then what happens? Then we have to work, like I just explained, pushing wheelbarrows of earth all morning. They never get us to do that, said the prisoners. We riot. But then what happens? And then we have our lunch. Oh, at least they have a lunch. All in the same bowl in our monastery. That's where the custard goes on the spaghetti. And the ice cream goes on the curry. Yuck, said the prisoners. Even in jail, they give you these metal plates with different compartments. Have you got any compartments in your bowl? No, it all gets mixed up. That's disgusting. So what do you do in the afternoon? Can you play sport? Play some tennis or soccer? No, the monks can't play any sport at all. Can you listen to some CDs? Play some music? None of that. Any sex? Of course not, we're monks. And what do you do all afternoon? We just meditate. Meditate all afternoon. That must be boring. At least you have dinner in the evening. No dinner. No supper. Oh, that's terrible. What do you do in the evening then? Can you play cards? Or play video games? No cards. No Monopoly. No video games. We just meditate. Oh, that's just too much. But what time do you go to bed? Maybe 10, maybe 11. Most of the monks sleep on the floor. on the floor. They don't even give you a cot or a bed to stay on. No, it's on the hard, cold floor. And when the prisoners heard how ascetic it is in a monastery like mine, they were so upset. They were so disappointed. They had so much compassion for their friend, the monk, who had to endure such hardship, that one of them, forgetting where they were, said, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us?" They invited him to come and stay in jail. And it's true. A jail in Australia is far more comfortable than my monastery. So do the monks in a monastery feel like prisoners? Is it a prison for them? And the answer, of course, is no. There's a waiting list to come and join my monastery. They're just trying to come in a monastery. They're trying their hardest to get out. So when I heard that, an insight occurred. The difference between being in prison and being free. The difference between being in prison and being free is any place you don't want to be becomes your prison. Doesn't matter how comfortable or austere it is, if you don't want to be here, you are in prison. If you don't want to be in this retreat, this temple is a prison for you. And it feels like a prison. If you don't want to be sitting on your mat, but you want to sort of go to bed, your mat is a prison. If you're in a relationship with your partner, you don't want to be there, your relationship is a prison for you. If you're in a job you don't like, your job is like a prison. If you're in a body which is old and sick, maybe hurting, and you don't want to be here in this painful body, then your body is your prison. Any place you don't want to be feels like a prison. In a monastery like mine, it is austere, it's not comfortable, but everyone wants to be there. That is why they feel free. Any place you like to be, you feel free. If you're happy to be here in this moment, you feel so free. So how to gain freedom from your partner? Do you have to get divorced? Is that the only way to escape the prison of an unpleasant relationship? And of course the answer is no. Change, doesn't matter how austere that relationship is. As soon as you change your attitude and you want to be here with that person, then you feel free. As soon as you appreciate the work you're doing in your job, and you're happy to be there, then you feel free. As soon as you're happy to be sitting on your meditation seat, this is good enough, then you are free. You are content. You have no business to do. Then you have peace of mind. To have freedom, peace of mind, contentment, you don't need to change your situation. You just change the way you look at it. That's all. Doesn't matter what state of mind you have, you make that freedom if you just are happy to be here. That's why for the last few days I've been saying, if you have sloth and torpor, be happy to have sloth and torpor. Don't make it a prison by not wanting to be here. If you're at peace with your sloth and torpor, completely content, this is good enough for me, then you feel this amazing freedom within that sloth and torpor. You are liberated, not by getting rid of the external situation, by being at peace with it. That's where you're free. If you have pain in your body, doesn't matter. Be happy to be here with that aching body, and then you are free. there's no problem anymore.
Just like in my monastery, it's ascetic, it's austere, but everyone's happy to be there. That is why they are free.
Now you understand the way to peace of mind, contentment, freedom, being happy to be in every moment, no matter what it is. No desire to go somewhere else. No aversion, thinking I don't want to be here. No comparing. Next moment will be better. The next retreat might be better. Maybe if I get another cushion, that'd be more comfortable. And then another one, another one. Don't ever think like that. This moment is good enough for contentment, for freedom. And once you get into that attitude, this thousand petal lotus, because you're not moving, your attention is just staying on this thing. This is good enough. I'm happy to be here with this one dirty old lotus. What you experience is all the petals opening up in quick succession. And what you thought was the most unpromising meditation of your life, painful, hot, tired, you go in and in and in and in. Petals after petals just opening up. You're just sitting here. You started off with an aching, hopeless type of mind. You said, this is good enough. I'm content with this. And you find that contentment opens up all the petals. You go into present moment because you don't want anything else. This is good enough. You go into silence. No need to think. You're content. You go onto the breath. You're content. It's great. The breath gets still. It gets beautiful. Disappears. Nimittas come up. You're just content with the nimitta. You're not getting excited and wanting to get into jhanas. And the jhanas happen. The whole thing just unfolds. And the jewel in the heart of that lotus, Nibbana itself, is revealed to you. Just with this amazing contentment. The end of desire. The end of ill will. The hindrances. The first two. The main obstacles to peace of mind. They are overcome. Same as loving kindness. You've heard me talk about loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to this moment, no matter what it is. Don't think you want to get jhanas before you can open up the door of your heart to this. Open it up now. Unconditional awareness. The door of my heart is open to this moment, no matter what it is. If it's really open, there's no comparison. Well, if you love your children, you love them for who they are. You don't compare them. This is what we mean by letting go. And by those attitudes, the mind becomes just so peaceful, so still, so quickly. And you find, that's how to meditate. It's not forcing the mind and having to spend hours and hours and hours and hours on the breath, and hours and hours and hours and hours on the full awareness of the breath, and hours and hours and hours on the next stage, and hours and hours and hours on the stage afterwards. Go to the heart of the matter, the essence of meditation, the letting go. Overcome the barriers. First of all, no worries, no future, no past. You can't predict it anyway, you don't know what's happening. So you let go of time. You don't measure the moment. You don't even think, how long have I sat meditation for? Don't even measure. Don't control. Let go. No desire, no aversion. Be familiar with the silence of the mind, the peace of the mind. Don't disturb the process. Whatever old lotus happens to be in your mind now, whatever experience of life in this moment, focus on that. This is good enough. Be content. Feel free. You don't want to get anywhere else. This is good enough for me. And you'll find the mind gets so peaceful, so still, it will blow you away. And you'll find just how easy it is to meditate, how blissful the mind can become when all those barriers of controlling, managing, interfering are all taken away. You just let go all the way into Nibbana. Wow, I didn't know it was so easy. That's how to overcome the barriers to peace of mind. Okay,
So where we go? Any questions about this evening's talk?
Was it a good talk? No, you've compared again. That was a trick question. And you'd
yes, in the back.
Sure, go. Is there such a thing as over-meditating? Nah. If you're meditating in the correct way, you can't meditate too much. You can't become too enlightened in this world. There's not enough enlightened people in this world. We can do with a few more of them. If you're meditating in the correct way, there's no such thing as over-meditating. But sometimes it's over-controlling in your meditation, where people strive so hard, they force the mind too much. Because of their forcing, they do get tense. And when I see people getting tense in meditation, I think, come on, look, you're missing the point. Meditation is supposed to be relaxing the mind, making it peaceful, making it still, getting rid of the stress, not adding more stress onto life. So if you come out of a meditation just so relaxed, so at ease, so loose, so free, so content, so still, you're going in the correct direction. And you can't overdo that fast. And it's great for other people as well. Remember that, you know, it's not just your own peace of mind, it's giving peace of mind to the people who have to put up with you, who have to endure you. Because if you're not peaceful, you know, you're just a pain in the neck. Because of all your demands and stuff, when you're really peaceful and kind and soft and lovely, you're great to be around. So sometimes we meditate for the sake of all other beings, to give them a break from our greed, hatred and delusion. Does that answer your question? Is that what you're asking? Or no? Please ask again. Go on. Okay, so the devil can never get inside when you're meditating. The only dangerous thing is not to meditate. That's really dangerous. Meditating is always very, very safe. Sometimes people say those things, that the devil is going to get into you when you're meditating, but it does have beauty, kindness. It's just like fear. Which people who are sort of afraid of the power of meditation, the freedom of meditation, and want to stop people being free. So when you meditate, you become completely free of all negative influences. That's why when you see people who know how to meditate, good meditators, they're such wonderful, compassionate, kind, caring, contributing beings in the world. You see that it's entirely good. The best time to meditate, you all know what the best time to meditate is? Now, there you go. The best time to meditate is always now, whenever that time is. So here had a question, yes? Yeah? That's right, it's a very good story. Ananda's enlightenment. He was invited to this big conference of monks. There were 500 monks invited. 499 were all completely enlightened, and he was the one who wasn't. It's exactly the same. If at the end of this retreat, I said, what, 65 people at this retreat? I said, well done, 64 of you are completely enlightened, you're arahants. And you were the one who wasn't. Oh, you feel so upset.
So that's what Ananda felt.
He felt, oh my goodness, I've been with the teacher, his constant companion, for over 20 years, and I'm not enlightened yet. So he decided to give everything he got that night. The reason I'm telling this story, because it fits into what I've just been talking about. He tried and tried and tried. He put forth immense effort, and he didn't get anywhere. It came just before dawn. He was as far away from enlightenment as he was when he started. So he gave up. He let go. He gave up trying to become enlightened. And according to the sutras, before his head hit the pillow, he was an arahant. Because he let go. This is another way to become enlightened, but it is not recommended. In the Theragata there was a nun. I think her name was Siha, like lion. She had been meditating not just for 9 days, but 7 years, like on a retreat, meditating day and night. And she said for 7 years, never once did she get any peace of mind. Never once in those 7 years. Now you know what it might be like for you after 9 days, you start complaining. 7 years! So she did not want to go back to the lay life. So she only had one choice. Suicide. She got a rope and she went into the forest. She climbed up a tree. She tied one end of that rope to a strong branch of the tree. She tied the other one to her neck, and she was just about to jump off when she became enlightened. That was a close call. That's why I don't encourage you to try the same. But the reason why she became enlightened, she was about to abandon everything, to let go even of her life. With that degree of letting go, of abandoning, just give up, that's where she became enlightened. So letting go, that is always the key. All of these disciples of mine have gone into really deep meditation. Like you've heard many of the tapes about that fellow in Perth who got so deep in meditation, was taken to the hospital. His family saved, nothing wrong with him. He just stopped breathing and he was brain dead, that's all. That's what I'll say it again for those who haven't heard it. Guy in Perth, meditator, usually only meditates for half an hour at a time, went in his bedroom, told his wife he was convinced of meditation. About an hour later, he was still in there, hadn't come out, so his wife went in to check him out and saw he was sitting there absolutely straight, couldn't see his chest go up and down, couldn't see any breath. She checked it out, he wasn't breathing. So she called the ambulance. And the ambulance came with the sirens blaring. The medics, they ran into his room, felt his pulse, couldn't find any pulse. And so they put him straight into the ambulance, and they rushed him to the local hospital, St. Charles Gardiner Teaching Hospital, and then they rushed him into the emergency room, they strapped on the ECG, measured your heartbeat, and the monitor, straight line, ding, 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 emergency, cardiac arrest. They put on the EEG onto his brain to see what was happening with his brain. Straight line again, ding, 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 brain dead. He was brain dead. For a while. It's all Adi Chag, permanent. And he was like that for, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. While the doctor was trying to revive him. Nothing worked, of course. But, after a while, he decided to come out of his meditation. And from laying back, he sat up. Where am I? I was in my bedroom. This isn't my bedroom. What's going on? And as soon as he came out of his meditation, the ECG was perfect, the EEG was perfect. And he walked home, nothing wrong with him. What a great story, it's a true one as well, it actually happened. But the thing was, I asked him afterwards, but he came and told me that, it's a great story. I asked him, and I knew what his answer would be. It's one of these questions you ask, you know what meditation is all about. What did you do? I said. How do you get into such a deep state of meditation? And his reply, standard reply, was, for the first time in my life, I really let go.
what he said. The first time in my life, I really let go.
You push the letting go button. That's what happens.
Really letting go.
And I spent the last hour and 20 minutes just explaining what letting go is. It's not comparing. Being content. This is good enough. So you're free no matter where you are. You let go of all this wanting. Let go of, no, this is not good enough for you, the person. Sit here, this is good enough. Not thinking about it, just watching. Not doing it, not managing. Just letting go. Allowing your mindfulness just to watch the lotus and not move from it. Just opens up all by itself. It's beautiful natural presence. One of these days, you will press that letting go button. Boom, boom, bam, bam. All these things open up. You get to such peaceful, beautiful state of mind. And then what will happen after you've done that once? You'll want it again. I want to do that again. And you forget about letting go and it'll be desire, 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 want, want, want. That's usually what happens. The first time you have a deep meditation experience, you don't get it again for many years because you try to get it back. And all that trying, all that craving, all that wanting, all that struggling is the very reason why it doesn't happen. And when you get it back again, you realize that letting go is the class. Great insights come up on what craving is, what attachment is, what doing is, what are these hindrances. You only know those hindrances when they're gone. Ah, that was what the hindrance was. And now it's gone. You're in these deep meditations. So you get all the insights just flow. You can't miss them. So these are the barriers for peace and bliss. And an ecstasy, which is not a prohibited drug, but which is a power of the mind. Any other questions? Yes. Can a sick person meditate? Oh my goodness, yes they can. I know from personal experience, there was in my, I think it was the second year as a monk, certainly in my years as a monk in Thailand, I think it was the second year as a monk. Like many of the monks in this monastery in northeast Thailand, I was very sick with a fever, which eventually I found out was scrub typhus. The history of this fever, this was in Wat Nanachat. In the monastery, Ajahn Chah told us Western monks to go to learn, not just how to be monks, but how to run monasteries. All the local villagers had a natural immunity to these little mites which lived in the forest, which once they bit you would spread the scrub typhus virus. However, because we were Westerners, we didn't have that natural immunity, and so just about all monks got the scrub typhus after a while. But you know, being one of the first monks there, I was one of the first to get the scrub typhus. No one knew what it was. And it was a very heavy fever. And so you got taken to the local hospital and put in the monk's ward. Now, this was over 30 years ago in northeast Thailand. At that time, Thailand was a third world country. And the northeast was the backwaters of that third world country. And the monk's ward was for the tough guys. So that was a tough hospital to be in. The first evening I was there with a drip in my arm, feeling just so weak and tired. After 6 o'clock, the nurse on duty walked away. By 7 o'clock, the replacement nurse hadn't come. So I asked the monk in the next bed, should we tell someone the night nurse hasn't come? He said, what do you mean, night nurse? There is no night nurse. If something happens in the night, that's just bad karma. I want to go home. So for 12 hours, you're on your own in a hospital. There's no night nurse there. And because they didn't know what type of fever it was, They just use the normal practice then of just injecting as many antibiotics as they could fit into the syringe. But the problem was, this was a third world country. So you don't have these syringes or the needles you just use once. These old type of needles which you keep on reusing many times. And they get used in Bangkok first of all before they get sent to the provinces. And because monks are supposed to be tough, they get used on ordinary people first of all, and last of all the monks get them. And so the nurse who used to inject me twice a day in the morning and afternoon in the buttocks was this big nurse who was built like a water buffalo, because you had to be that strong to stab this thing in your backside, and that hurt. And even now as a monk, twice a day you see this big nurse coming in, oh no, here we go, bang, ow! So it was very unpleasant, and you had this terrible fever, and it was, you were so weakened that I remember when you used to go to the toilet, there was no bedpans. You had to just try and get to the toilet by yourself. It was like climbing Mount Everest. Because my bed was about 5 or 6 beds away from the toilet, you would actually stand up and take another 5 minutes to steady yourself before you literally lurched to the next bed and grabbed on before you fell over, until you got some more energy to make the next move. I'm not joking, it was about 30 minutes to get to the toilet, because no one was able to help you. And when you got to the toilet, you stayed there a long time to make sure you got everything done, because you weren't going to do this more than once or twice in a day. And that's how weak you felt. And the reason I tell this story, without exaggeration, I try not to exaggerate as a monk, but one day I was feeling so low, as a fever does, I was there about 3 or 4 weeks, you get so low with a fever, just all your energy gets burnt up, you feel so tired. I decided, right, this is it, I'm going to meditate properly. And I just meditated and got this beautiful meditation. The body all disappeared, nice bliss. And of course, the contrast was so great, because I'd just been really feeling awful, like you do with a fever. You know, sore buttocks to this nurse. And I got this beautiful meditation. When I came out afterwards, the first thing I did, interesting, was check my posture. My posture was all over the place. I'd never seen that posture in any manual on meditation. But it worked for me. That taught me your posture is not important. You can get in the deepest of meditations, no matter what your legs are doing, no matter where your arms are, no matter what. But it also taught me you can get into deep meditation with a fever, with really feeling really sick. You can do it. It's incredibly beneficial. The only people it's difficult, you've got to be careful when you're meditating, is anyone who suffers schizophrenia. Because schizophrenia is a little disease which is an imbalance of some chemicals in the brain. It works okay, you can be fine as long as you keep taking that medication which balances the chemicals in the brain. But if you have a schizophrenia, then sometimes in meditation, just because of the increase of mindfulness, the superpower of mindfulness, it exaggerates those delusions and people go a little bit more crazy. So it's only if someone's got schizophrenia, you have to be very, very careful with them when they're doing meditation. If it's depression, there's no problem at all. Depressed people have a lot of fun in meditation. They get all the energies coming up, powerful mindfulness. They get so powerful that sometimes they can give up the medication. Get cured. Depression is a great thing. If you've got depression, come to meditation. So it's great to meditate when you're sick. Any other questions anyone has? I don't know about here, but I know that in many of the hospitals in Australia they have meditation rooms in the hospitals. Because they know that meditation is a great thing to do. It's not prayer rooms, it's just for meditation. It's not just Buddhists and the Christians get into it, everyone gets into it, because it's so well known that a bit of meditation, lessening the stress, relaxing, letting go, being peaceful, being at ease, it's so helpful for any sickness which you have, or if you had an operation, for actually healing those wounds. It's just a plus for everything.
That's why. Many of those little books which I've written, that little green book of the basic method of meditation, they keep leaving me in all the doctor's surgeries around Perth. And just for patients to learn some meditation. They're just Christians, Hindus, whoever. It doesn't matter. It's good stuff for how to learn meditation to relax. And all the doctors are really into it because they know it works. Yes. How do you teach children how to meditate? You have to do it for a small time first of all. You get them early when they're very young. They're natural meditators. Just learn them to sit down and just be still or just be quiet. There's actually many books about teaching children how to meditate, which are printed in the West. I know Kathleen McDonald did one. She's an Australian girl. She's a nun now. Teaching children how to meditate. Kathleen McDonald. But any of those books about teaching children to meditate are really good. All you need to do is to get the kids to actually to feel that peace, feel that stillness. Sometimes you can get them to do some visualization and maybe watch the breath, make it a bit of fun. Start out for short periods at first, not too long, until the children get used to it, and then they can go longer and longer and longer. And all the kids who do meditation are amazing kids. They've just got another skill which other kids don't have. Their concentration is so good, they do well at school, and just socially, they're more relaxed. Because you know, you can remember, even in adolescence, what it's like. They're trying to sort of get by, and when you have this peacefulness, this stillness there, it's many of these problems which young people have, you just don't have. It's a great thing to do. It's not that hard. But don't force it. Meditation should be fun. And hopefully that, you know, I've encouraged that. Fun meditation. When it's fun, it's nice and peaceful and still and free, then you want to meditate. And the kids want to meditate as well. It's not sort of some penance you have to do because you're a Buddhist. And when it's fun, you want to do it. The mind wants to do it. You do it more and more, and it gets more and more fun, more and more joyful, more and more benefits. Yeah? Okay. Sorry, what's the last word? If example?
For example, when you are at a dentist
chair. Oh, dentist chair, yeah. I love going to the dentist. Because when I go to the dentist, they put all this stuff in your mouth. It's one time when no one can ask me any questions. So I'm actually free. It's the most comfortable chair. I never get chairs like that in our monastery. Just relax, going back. Yeah, what you do, you just go to the present moment. Just now. And so you don't go worrying about any pain or any problem like that, because the fear is one of the biggest things with pain. Because about dentists, it reminds me of that story I wrote in my book about one of the members of my community in Perth. He had very bad teeth. And he didn't like having the injections. So when he had his teeth out, whenever he had a number of teeth had to be pulled out, he found one dentist in Perth who was willing to take his teeth out without any anaesthetic. So it was in the teething hospital. And this fellow got quite well known around the dentist in Western Australia, being this guy, he can take his teeth out no problem at all. But one day he did even better than that, because our monastery is about an hour from the city, and he thought, why go all that way to the dentist in town? I'll take the teeth out myself. So that's what he did. And we found him outside the workshop with one of his tooth covered with blood in the pliers. That's a madness. And
we asked him after, I saw him there and his bloody tooth in the pliers. I said, how did you do that? And this is what he said, is such a good explanation of how to meditate when you're going to a dentist or you can have some operation. He said, when I decided to pull out my own tooth, that didn't hurt. Making the decision didn't hurt. When I walked to the workshop, walking didn't hurt. When I picked up that pair of pliers, picking up a pair of pliers doesn't hurt. When I put the pliers on the tooth, that didn't hurt. When I wiggled those pliers, it hurt for about 2 seconds, that's all, then the tooth was out. And afterwards it didn't hurt, hardly at all, once the tooth was out. Say 2 or 3 seconds, that's all. Big deal. But when I was telling that story to you, even though it wasn't your tooth, it already hurt you, didn't it? Oh, that would be terrible. If that was you, even though when you made the decision, it would start to hurt. The point is, how much of pain is expectation and fear? 99% of it is. Because pulling out a tooth, 2 or 3 seconds, that's all. Then it's out. But it's the anticipation, the fear of it. That's the killer. So when you meditate, if you're in the present moment, you don't worry about the next moment. You're just in this moment, and that means you can really relax. When you stop thinking about it, you have silence in the mind. Again, you're really relaxing. And that way you're not tensing up against whatever procedure is happening. So how many times your dentist said, relax, relax. Or just when you have, sometimes before you have the injection, you have to have a pre-op to relax you before you get the anesthetic. Just, if you meditate, you don't need those things. You just relax with no fear, because you don't think about it. The same with, you've got a child who's doing an examination. For many kids, doing A-levels or whatever is even worse than going to the dentist. Because they think about it a lot, they worry so much, that's why they never do well. If you teach them, be in the present moment, silence, then by the time they get into the examination room, only then do they start thinking about the exam. So they relax, they're open. That's why they do very well. Does that make sense to you? I know lots of people have done that. I remember this one lady, she came and told me she was having an operation because she had cancer of the sinuses. And she said that she had a pre-op and anaesthetic and she was being wheeled into the theatre. She was still absolutely fully conscious. The anaesthetic wasn't working. Because sometimes it doesn't work, you know, in some cases. And so she said, this is going to really hurt. They're going to start cutting me up soon. And she was so afraid. Then she remembered Ajahn Brahm's meditation. So she started letting go and just watching her breath. She did the counting of the breath. And she only got from maybe, you know, breathing in one, breathing out two, breathing in three, out three. Just after a short while, that she just allowed the anaesthetic to happen and just, she was unconscious. Just one or two breaths was all it took. But she said if she hadn't done that, she would have allowed, the fear would have been stronger than the anaesthetic. So she did some meditation just as she was going in. And it was okay. Well, there's another story. This friend of mine many years ago who was a monk, he was from the Bronx in New York. And he said his sister wrote to him this experience. She did a stupid thing. She decided to do her washing in a laundrette after work, late at night. In those days, 25 years ago, you just don't do that. So she was in there by herself, a young woman, when this big black man came in and told her to take her skirt down, pulled out a gun. She was about to be raped, and she knew it was a stupid thing to do. She shouldn't go to those places at that time of night, you know, just in that area. So she made a run for it, pushed the guy over, started running, but the guy quickly got up and shot her twice. And she said she was doubly lucky that she fell in the doorway, banged on the door,
Usually no one opens, but the owner opened that door, dragged her inside and called the ambulance. And they got her to the hospital. She survived, only just. But she said the reason why she survived, and the reason why the doctor said she survived, because they were very surprised she made it to the hospital. Because after she was shot, she started doing her meditation to relax. And so that meditation, which she did, just relaxing, letting go, being at peace, being still, saved her life after she was shot. Later they found that that man who tried to rape her, he was a serial rapist who would always rape the woman and then kill her. So if she'd have stayed, she'd have been killed for sure. And she, as her sister, one of the monks, and so she told the story and told how the meditation had literally saved her life. Powerful thing to be able to do. Sometimes it's the difference between being alive and being dead. You know how to relax when it's really necessary. And also, you ladies, if you're having a baby, if you meditate, especially when you're in the labour, really relax. You find your labour pains are very short, easy to cope with, and your baby comes out nice and quickly. Saves a lot of time. Fast delivery. There's so many things, ways you can help. So anyway, the talk this evening was all about overcoming the barriers to peace of mind. And it's especially for you meditators here, because hopefully I can remove some of those barriers so you can really get into some deep states of meditation during this retreat. So please remember what those were. First of all, being in the present moment, stop measuring time, stop being a controller, remembering that become familiar with not thinking, the space between thoughts. If the thinking is bothering you, just listen to when one thought finishes before another begins. Familiarize yourself with that inner silence, which is always there. And then it will start to grow. When it happens, you'll be comfortable there, you won't want to disturb it. And learn just how to be content. It doesn't matter what you're experiencing, this is good enough. Stop comparing it with something else. Otherwise you get into desire or aversion. And remember that beautiful stimuli of the lotus. So all you need to do is just watch. Don't move. Don't do anything. Just watch. And the lotus opens up all by itself. And you'll be amazed just how the most unlikely starts become the most beautiful meditations. Okay? So, now we'll give the sharing of the merits before we finish off this evening.